Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're celebrating Autism Awareness Month with the Director of Clinical Services at Autism Speaks. We're going to discuss the role of early screening, recognizing the signs of autism, and the disproportionate impact it's having among minority populations. We'll also be breaking down stigmas about this prevalent condition. And then we're going to be connecting with Connecticut's DEEP Commissioner, Katie Dykes, to chat up the state's 20 by 20 initiative, which was launched a couple of years ago to improve the transparency, predictability, and efficiency of Connecticut's regulatory processes across 20 targeted areas by the end of 2020. And we're going to close here during Child Abuse Prevention Month with our buddies from BACA, Bikers Against Child Abuse. You'll find out how much heart so many of these rough-looking bikers have and how so many here in Connecticut and around the globe are willing to step up with proven, safe, and effective intervention and support systems that are making such a positive difference for victims of child abuse. We're going to be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. With many residents still working from home through the pandemic, more home DIY projects are underway, and that can bring the danger of exposure without knowing what's below the surface, risks causing property damage, injury, and even death, according to representatives of Call Before You Dig right here in Hamden, Connecticut. Call Before You Dig is a nonprofit safety call center in Hamden, reminding Connecticut homeowners and contractors about public safety and to go to CBYD.com for an e-ticket or to call 811 at least two full working days before doing any kind of digging or excavating during construction projects or simple home DIY projects this season. It's the law and it's free. Call 811 or go to CBYD here during April, Call Before You Dig Month. Well, around the world and here in the United States and in Connecticut, we're celebrating Autism Awareness Month. As we broadcast this on Sunday, we have already gotten past World Autism Day, which was last Friday, and we're so pleased to welcome a leader in the autism world. Dr. Pam Dixon is on the line with us, and she is Director of Clinical Services at Autism Speaks. Pam, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we've got quite a packed program to try to get through here in the next 15 minutes. And as we indicated in our program introduction, we want to share some important information and points regarding recognizing the signs of autism, the benefits of early screening and diagnosis, what parents need to know, breaking down some stigmas. But first of all, over the past 10 or 15 years, we've seen that meter clicking up and up and up in terms of the proportion of young people diagnosed with autism here in the country. Where do we stand right now in terms of how many kids out of 100 or what the statistical ratio is in terms of individuals diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder?
Sure. So we're looking at an estimated 1 in 54 children, according to the Center for Disease Control's latest figures.
Okay. Well, let's first talk about just a quick crash lesson on what autism actually is.
Sure. So autism spectrum disorder is a condition that is characterized by challenges with social functioning, social communication, and the presence of repetitive behaviors or what we call restricted interests, or which are like over-focused interests that can get in the way of daily life.
Okay. And I know I may have already violated or misstepped in my description, because the way we talk about autism and individuals impacted by it is really important. What is the currently accepted or preferred terminology when we're talking about autism and referring to an individual? Do we say that they have autism spectrum disorder, ASD, they're autistic? How do we talk to other people who may have children on the spectrum about that and not be offensive to them?
Sure. I think that's a very sensitive question. I'm glad that you brought it up. And it really depends on the person. I think it comes down to respecting how the parent or the person with autism wants to be referred. So, in the broader disability community, there's this terminology called person first, where you refer to the person before whatever the disabling condition is that they have. But there are many people with autism who would prefer to be called autistic and embrace the fact that they embrace neurodiversity and would rather have that come, be the lead with autistic. So I would say just make sure that you understand how a person wants to be referred to.
Very good. It's also really important, as in many types of issues, to identify autism spectrum disorder as early as possible in order to create and enhance programming and support to help that individual. Can you talk a little bit about recognizing the signs of autism and how young parents or caregivers might be able to start seeing signs of autism spectrum disorder so that they can begin to initiate that support?
Sure. So we can reliably diagnose autism at by 18 months, but parents often report seeing signs, as early as 12 months. And some of those signs include things like difficulty with eye contact, so a child who averts their gaze, or if a child's not responding to their name, or they are not using gestures that you see young children commonly use, like they're not waving or they're not pointing to get access to things. Another sign is if a child is doing repetitive things with objects, so lining things up, or if they have repetitive body movements, like flicking of fingers or flapping of hands or arms. And then another important thing is that if a child at any point loses skills, so if they lose language or other skills, that's another red flag.
Okay. As far as Autism Speaks is concerned, or based on your own personal opinion, how is America's pediatric community doing in terms of both playing an important role between the parents and caregivers and support systems that can help individuals on the spectrum? I'm talking about, parents who may go to pediatricians and indicate that they are seeing some of the signs you just described, and having those pediatricians become proactive versus taking a wait and see approach and giving that child another 6 months or a year to quote unquote catch up.
Sure. So I think what we are recommending is that parents complete a screener, and they can access a screener at the screenforautism.org. And this is a 2-minute screening questionnaire that they can complete, print out, and take to their pediatrician to have so that there's a common language to express concerns and to have this conversation. And, I think that the pediatric community is improving and is very focused on lowering the age of diagnosis as well. Out of respect, for that community, pediatricians spend a lot of their day with helping parents feel calmer about what their concerns are. And so that has also followed into autism diagnosis. But I think they are increasingly aware of the time-sensitive nature of an autism diagnosis have made strides in improving, knowledge about soil for diagnostic evaluation.
Okay. Turning to the parents or caregivers, if they are noticing these signs, but they are the ones who have decided we're going to hold off on screening and we're just going to give our child a little bit more time to catch up, maybe moving into the 18-month to 3-year-old period. Can you articulate what the benefits are and the differences between creating an early diagnosis and response situation at 18 to 36 months versus once the child has gotten into the 3 to 5-year-old range?
So what we know from research is that early intensive intervention can make a huge difference in a child's overall development. And so that's the reason that we are advocating for early screening and to lower this age of diagnosis, because we want children to be able to have the diagnosis so that they can access services. They access intervention, and that's going to help them to develop speech, and it will promote their cognitive development. It will make it easier for them to learn daily living skills. And also for parents, it will give parents and the skills, the strategies that they need to be able to support their child's development. So it's really, important. There's a lot of learning that goes on naturally during these early years. And so we want children to be able to benefit from this this early time and all of this brain development that's going on.
Great. Well, similar.
So those are the important reasons. Yeah.
Good. Well, similar to other conditions, unfortunately, autism spectrum disorder has a significantly greater impact on minority populations and those of a lower socioeconomic status. Can you talk a little bit about how Autism Speaks and the autism support community is working hard to respond to try to kind of create a level playing field, so to speak, in terms of recognition and access to support?
Sure. So one of the ways that we're doing that is this screening measure is available in English as well as Spanish, and we have a Spanish language version of our website. And on the website, autismspeaks.org, there are materials available, as I mentioned, in Spanish, but in many other languages, so that families have access to information about autism. We have an autism response team that is available via phone as well as email that can provide parents with information about what's available to them locally. And we also are coming alongside, community members who are focused on, specific minority groups to help develop local interventions and supports.
Very good. Aside from the impact and the kind of disproportionate effect on minority and lower socioeconomic groups, COVID-19 has also been the second of a 1-2 punch against this community in terms of identifying autism spectrum disorder. Can you talk for a moment about that?
Sure. So, because of sheltering in place, families have, not been able to access their healthcare providers in the way that they were able to beforehand. And so it has really resulted in longer waiting lists for evaluation. And in many communities, these wait lists were there before have just lengthened. And so, another reason that we are encouraging families to do the screener so that when it, they can use that to have this very clear conversation about their concerns with their primary care physician.
Okay. Before we let you go, we have to address one more concern that really has been the subject of entire segments on this award-winning For the People program that we do here, and certainly has been a focus of numerous parts of segments on a number of developmental disorders as well as ASD. Let's talk about the stigmatizing factor. I know America and Connecticut is getting better in terms of recognizing, you know, all of the flavors and all of the information related to autism. But let's just speak briefly before we have to let you go about how much more difficult the stigmatizing factor makes it, not just on the individual who may be impacted with autism spectrum disorder, but their entire immediate support network, their family and loved ones.
Sure. I think the you know, the way that stigma has a big impact is that it makes caregivers, be it whether it's parents or other family members, hesitant to seek out a diagnosis. And so in that way, it can result in a child not accessing diagnosis and services as early as they might. So, you know, we encourage people to visit our website at autismspeaks.org, where they can kind of hear some of the stories of people, you know, across the spectrum and the lifespan, to see how people are reaching their full potential with services and support, so that they can realize that, you know, that a diagnosis is important for opening doors, but should not be something that is that limits a person.
Is there one prevailing misconception about individuals on the autism spectrum that when you hear about it, it just really kind of gets under your skin and you want to just, you know, kind of shout from the rooftops that this is simply not true?
I think it's that that all people with autism are the same, right? And the reason that is, you know, it's challenging for me here is that, you know, people with autism are like anyone else in that, you know, they have their individual characteristics and strengths and things that need shoring up. And so it's unfair, you know, to say that, you know, everyone with autism is the same.
Very good. We're kicking off Autism Awareness Month with Dr. Pam Dixon. She's Director of Clinical Services at Autism Speaks. Very pleased to have her here. Don't forget, early screening and detection is the first step toward addressing autism spectrum disorder and supporting the individual involved. Go to autismspeaks.org for more information and to learn about their screening program, available now in English and Spanish across the country and here in Connecticut. Dr. Dixon, thank you so much for your time this morning, and best of luck in your work with Autism Speaks. Well, as I related to our guest for this segment, the Connecticut DEP and now DEEP and their leaders have been so responsive to the award-winning For the People here for almost 30 years. And I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of Commissioner Katie Dykes, who is the current DEEP commissioner, and all the more excited to be talking about a project that she is so passionate about, and that is 20 by 20, this program that was kicked off in 2019 to improve the transparency, predictability, and efficiency of the DEEP's and Connecticut's regulatory processes across 20 targeted areas by the end of 2020. And Commissioner Dykes, I will turn it over to you because we are celebrating some great success over the past few weeks. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, we are. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about our 20 by 20 initiative. It's something that we launched in 2019 we were setting goals for ourselves within DEEP about ways we can better achieve our mission of environmental protection and environmental conservation and providing clean, reliable, and affordable energy. And I realized we have such incredible men and women working in our department, just delivering on this mission for the citizens of Connecticut every day. And I wanted to share the progress that we were making, you know, with these goals and the intentions we were setting with the public and with our stakeholders, so that people could follow along with our progress in meeting these goals, and also be part of the process and give us input on how we can better provide better service to the public.
Yeah.
The key focus of this initiative is around improving the transparency and the efficiency and the predictability of our various regulatory processes across DEEP. We have a very diverse, you know, mission and set of programs, over 125 different permitting processes, for example. And we've been innovating a lot of ways to deliver those programs, again, more efficiently. And so this is the goal of the initiative. And we are really excited about the results. Now that we're into 2021, we've completed these goals. We set for the end to share that progress with the public.
Yeah, I was going to say, 2020 has been a tough year on all kinds of projects, large and small, and really kind of giving yourself about a little under a 2-year window to accomplish these 20 initiatives, given the impact that COVID has had working remotely and trying to get the frontline work done that your agency and the thousands of people that are involved with DEEP, has been quite a challenge, and hitting that 80% mark in terms of complete accomplishments or better is certainly laudable to you and your organization and its people. So congratulations on that. So my understanding was, back when you started formulating the 20 by 20 program, there were hundreds of various applications that were pending. And one of the premier goals was cutting that backlog, which is what you accomplished. Talk a little bit about how how you came at that pile of applications and were able to work through and trim it down so well.
Right. So we had, as you said, a backlog of legacy, what we call legacy permits, permit applications. Those are permit applications that have been with the department for 24 months or longer. We had 331 that were pending in 2019, and we've cut that backlog 45% by the end of 2020. At the same time, you know, that we've been working through that backlog, of course, we have, you know, new permit applications that have been coming through the door. And we set a related goal of establishing benchmarks of, you know, an expected time frame of how long each type of permit application should take to process. And we developed a dashboard to measure our progress in meeting those benchmark timeframes for every new permit application that comes in the door. Mm. So, you know, in some cases, of course, there's only so many hours in the day, right? We only have so many staff at DEEP. So this effort to whittle down that pile of legacy permit decisions is all the more laudable in the context of, you know, that we've been keeping the trains running, keeping the new applications kind of moving through the process and making great strides, I think, in many areas. You know, some of this, of course, there's a lot of benefits of working through the backlog, of course, you know, provides answers for businesses. We want to spur economic development and economic activity here in the state. It also helps to resolve, you know, outstanding issues that may be, you know, affecting environmental quality impacting local communities. So there's an environmental benefit and an economic development benefit when we are able to move these decisions forward. But in some cases, they've been, you know, lingering because they're really tough.
Yeah.
Well, these are not the easy ones usually when there's something that's been sitting for a little while.
Yeah, and not just chewing down the backlog by almost half, but also at the same time scripting up and getting a couple of landmark regulations adopted. And we're just going to take a moment to take a quick break and talk more about it. We'll be back with DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes talking about the agency's 20 by 20 initiative right after this. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. I love it when two organizations we support here on For the People come together. And on Tuesday, April 27th, that's happening with A Promise to Jordan, hosting a virtual presentation by our good friend Ginger Katz, founder of the Courage to Speak Foundation. This two-hour session begins at 6 p.m. as Ms. Katz shares the story of her son Ian's losing his battle with drugs that started in eighth grade with tobacco, alcohol, and marijuana through his junior year in college when he died from heroin and prescription drug overdose. Katz will also cover the development of the Courage to Speak elementary, middle, and high school curricula, along with the Courage to Speak Courageous Parenting 101 program. Learn more about the Courage to Speak Foundation by visiting couragetospeak.org and get involved and register for the presentation now by visiting apromisetojordan.org. Well, we're back with DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes, and I've got to say, I've had a relationship with the Naugatuck Valley Brownfields initiative for, God, probably as close to the amount of time I've been on the radio, 25 plus years. And so I learned a lot about Brownfields way back. And coincidentally, this is one of the big accomplishments in terms of regulations. What's the lowdown on this new Brownfield and contaminated site regulation?
Oh, well, this one, it's really exciting. So we know that we have a legacy of industrial sites, you know, dating back to the Industrial Revolution. You know, Connecticut has had a lot of manufacturing over the years, a lot of industry that has come and gone. And that means that we have a legacy of some contaminated sites, especially in our urban areas, that is holding back development and can be a barrier for our cities to return these sites back to productive reuse. It is an important environmental goal for us to remediate brownfields because that prevents sprawl from occurring. You know, these are valuable sites that are close to transportation and electrical infrastructure and so on, close to workers. But, you know, they have to be remediated. Otherwise, developers are going to be looking to less impacted properties, you know, out in our forests, out in our agricultural areas to develop their new sites. So it's there's many benefits when we can remediate sites. We are laser focused at the department on removing barriers and to cleanup of contaminated sites. And there's a number of things we've been doing in that regard. One major initiative that we prioritized in the 20 by 20 effort was to move forward two regulations that have been pending for some time at the department that will reduce the time involved and the cost of cleanups of brownfields and contaminated sites. One of them is the remediation standards regulations, which provides predictability, clear standards, and consistent standards in a comprehensive way for the first time about how clean is clean to guide developers and the licensed environmental professionals who advise them on exactly what standards are needed to achieve the cleanup of the site in a comprehensive way. Another, the environmental use restrictions regulation. This is a really interesting one, John, because we recognize that if you're cleaning up a brownfield, How much you need to remediate may be different depending on what you're planning to use that property for in the future. If you're planning to put a daycare on that facility, we want that site to be pristine. But if you're planning an industrial use, it may be possible to clean it up to a lesser degree, so long as we've provided clear notice to any future purchaser of that property about the degree to which it's been cleaned up, so that if they did in the future, you know, someone new bought the property, decided to put the daycare there, that they're going to be on notice that they need to do some additional work to bring it up to the proper standards to protect public health. And so those environmental use restrictions that, you know, provide that permanent notice about the degree to which something's been cleaned up can be really helpful to enable a developer of a property to get over that cost barrier of cleanup that is calibrated to what their expected use is. That's very helpful for us to make it really economic for folks to move forward with the cleanup of these programs. And it provides great flexibility as well as clear protections and transparency for community, for the local community, for other stakeholders about the relative contamination on the site. So those are the kinds of things that are really going to get folks off the sidelines, get properties cleaned up. And, you know, John, it's so important right now, given the impact of this pandemic on our economy, that we can remove these barriers to economic activity and to bringing these contaminated sites in our cities back into productive use. So we're excited about how this effort is actually going to be contributing to the economy roaring back from some of the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Excellent. In the last 4 or 5 minutes that we have with you, let's talk a little bit about, making things easier on those who are applying for permits. I'm talking about the permit concierge office.
Yes. So for the first time, we've established a one-stop shop office holder for developers or legislators, municipal officials, as well as stakeholders to reach out to DEEP and find out information about how to do processes. We've heard from businesses, if they're moving forward with a complex development, they may need multiple permits from DEEP. And so by going through the concierge office, they have a single point of contact who can help coordinate multiple reviews within the office. It shows, we want to be a partner with applicants to make sure they know the sequence of different permits they need, how to make sure that their applications are complete and have all the underlying information that we're going to need to do a review effectively. That's one of the best ways we can cut down on review times is if we make sure we've got all the information we need up front. These are the ways that our concierge office can benefit applicants, and stakeholders, and benefit DEEP and help us get to better decisions faster. And it's been fun. You know, John, we've gotten some outreach from other states since we launched the concierge office, looking to learn more about what we've done and see if there's ways that they can copy the success. So we're really excited to share with people about the availability of that service. We've also been providing for more convenience for folks in terms of scanning files online and, you know, providing for access to documents through an online data portal, another great convenience that's been essential during COVID when people are working from home.
Great. If folks want to review the 20 by 20 report, they just go to ct.gov/DEEP and it'll be somewhere obvious on the homepage.
That's right. We've got all the information about the project, and you can read quarterly reports to track our progress on all of these goals, as well as to find out how to access the concierge service, our online databases, and information about some of these regulations that we've put in place that are helping to streamline our processes. But we're just really excited about all the engagement and support we've received through this process, and happy to share this effort with the public. It's I always love to brag on our staff at DEEP. I think we have the best staff working in our department, and this is a great example of the innovation and the dedication that they've been providing, right, especially during a pandemic. It's pretty remarkable.
Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection launched its 20 by 20 initiative in June of 2019 to improve the transparency, predictability, and efficiency of the agency's regulatory processes across 20 areas by the end of 2020. Even with the onus of the COVID-19 pandemic, they were able to complete over 80% of those goals. They are all available for you to review in the report. DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes has been our guest for this midline segment. And Katie, we look forward to talking with you again about more of the things that your organization is doing, because it touches so many people, virtually everyone here in Connecticut. So look forward to another conversation soon. Thank you for this time, and we will be in touch. Thanks. Well, we started the program today talking about Autism Awareness Month, but now we're going to focus on another demographic of young people in recognizing that April is also Child Abuse Prevention Month. And a few years ago, we had the distinct pleasure of getting to know some of the representatives of Connecticut's Bikers Against Child Abuse, BACA, and we are circling back with a couple of new friends from BACA, and we'll explain a little bit as to why we're referring to them as Happy and T. Now, Happy, you're the president of the of BACA here in Connecticut, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Very good. And T, what's you're kind of the communications guy?
I'm the treasurer and PR guy.
Very good. Well, T, give us the rundown on the whole assumed name situation.
Yeah, we're using our ride names, and that's to really prevent any backlash against BACA members.
Mm-hmm. So
BACA is a fully volunteer group of individuals looking to empower kids that have been abused.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, how long have you been involved with the cause?
I've been involved about 5 years now. Happy has been involved for 15 years.
Okay. So let me switch gears and talk to Happy for a couple seconds. Happy, with your time involved with this group, you can talk a little bit about both how the network of fellow bikers has grown as they've come to this cause, and what a difference that you're making, not just really to the children and families who are victims of abuse, but the stigmas that you're breaking down in the general community of folks that might still think that, you know, generally most bikers are more up to no good than doing good, which is really never been my experience or opinion, but sadly the stigma remains. Let's talk a little bit about how this group has grown in the 15 years you've been heading it up.
Well, I came in the early part of 2005, and at that point, our organization, I believe, probably had about 70 chapters in the U.S. alone. And it wasn't until probably around 2005, 2006, maybe a little bit sooner, that we actually started reaching out and became an international, worldwide organization. We now have chapters in almost all of North America. We're starting chapters in South America. We're in Europe. We have some interest in Asia, as well as Africa and Oceania, Australia, New Zealand.
Mm.
So that gives you an idea of roughly we've grown fast and immensely over the last 25 years since the organization has been around, but our mission has never changed. And we've always had the same mission. It's never changed, and that is to keep children safe and not be afraid of the world in which they live.
That's right. And here in America and around the world, child abuse knows no racial or socioeconomic barriers. It really is happening all over the place. And it really reflects your membership. I mean, I got to imagine you have, corporate types that ride on the weekend or during the warmer seasons. And you've got, guys and women who are out there whenever they can get the bike out on the road, lifers, so to speak. Tell me a little bit about how you attract and qualify new members to the BACA family.
We attend some of the local events, some of the bike runs, and at times due to our fundraising events that we hold, people will inquire to us. We also get inquiries through our international website for people that are interested. And one of the things is that what we do is not for everybody. It's not like you got a motorcycle, you can put a vest on, you go ride around and be Johnny Cool. It's a 24/7 dedication that you have to put out there, and you have to have your family support to do that. And all of our members that come into our organization before, we even let them around our kids or become familiar with who we are and what we really do, our FBI background check cleared prior to them assuming any attempt to become a member, a full patch member in our organization.
And is there any type of actual training that the members undergo? Because I understand from my previous guests and learning about you guys years ago that you've got a really successful kind of system. And to your credit, as you said, you've really got one narrow focus, and that is to help protect and empower abused children and families not to be afraid in the world. And that probably kind of plays into the way you go about accomplishing that mission. Let's talk a little bit about how you do it.
Yeah, we have a training plan, just about like any major corporation does. For the first 90 days that a person wants to become a member and after they are cleared, they're strictly confined, basically, besides attending the meetings and maybe events that we host, are dedicated to their training to become familiar with our organization, how to act themselves, how to conduct themselves in court as well as in public, and how they should be acting once they pass their 90-day kind of like a pre-trial, time frame.
Yep.
Before we let them around our kids. So they have in the first 90 days enough training to keep them busy so they don't have to worry about the other stuff that the other chapter members have been cleared and move forward in their progress to do what they need to do to take care of kids. For us, it's a continuous learning pattern. Continuously, every day. Our rules and regulations change because we have to abide with the federal, state, and local rules and regulations. Our training is geared to what is currently effective as far as working with kids, communication, conflict resolution, courtroom etiquette, those kind of things. And for us, it's a continuous yearly, educational growth in the sense you may do something in January and changes come out in the middle of the summer. And by the end of the year, we've updated our training and you're required to continue to be updated as to what we provide as training for our members.
Excellent. We're about halfway through our chat with Happy and T. They are leaders of Connecticut's BACA, the Bikers Against Child Abuse organization, now global in its scope and welcoming thousands and thousands of members around the world and hundreds here in Connecticut. We're talking with Happy. He has been the president of BACA here in Connecticut and involved with the cause for over 15 years. So we talked a little bit about the people who come to BACA to be members and to be trained and to give the help. T, let's give Happy a break and talk to you a little bit about how you come to know and intervene with the victims.
Well, individuals can contact us through the hotline that's on the website. We have a Connecticut hotline. They could also call the organization hotline, and they'll get referred to us. In Connecticut, it's 860-420-7388. Our hotline, and they can talk to someone within BACA and describe the problem, and then we'll come out and visit with them, talk to them some more, and if it meets all the conditions, then we'll do a level one with them, where we introduce the child to our family.
And what's the website, if you don't mind?
It's BACAWorld.org.
Okay, and then from there they can click in through to get to Connecticut information?
Correct. And there's a super video that's on the site that'll give them an idea of what to expect when they engage with BACA.
Okay. Now, you talked about people can just call BACA and potentially engage your support. How does that sit, or how do you interact with judicial law enforcement and more conventional support systems that also may be involved in the case?
Well, we work with them. We don't replace, or we're just focused on our narrow mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll work with state or local health officials that might be involved, the police department. But for the most part, we're there for the child.
Good. Let's also, we didn't want to let you go without reminding folks here as we are entering April Child Abuse Prevention Month, that while this is an epidemic issue here in Connecticut and across the country, COVID-19 has only made things worse. Happy or T, you want to speak to that point?
Yeah, there have been some numbers, posted in the news that there's been an upsurge in child abuse, because now, if you think about it, that kid is locked in a home with a perpetrator 24/7. So we, from what I understand, I think it was in England, it went up to 53%. Mm. I've talked to some of my chapters in some of the other states, and it's gone up as high as 60-65% increase in child abuse.
And that's what we know now. I mean, it could be much, much worse. You've got kids that have been isolated from schools, from counselors, from daycare, you've got adults and kids that are stressed to the max. I mean, it really is creating a perfect storm of conditions that these kids are being faced with.
Hmm. So when people call you or you get referred to victims and you qualify them, speak directly to them about what they're going to experience once BACA attaches itself and all your members come to support that individual's situation.
So once we bring a child or children into our family, is they're assigned two people to that individual child and to each child in the family, 24/7 contact with two BACA members. We always go by the two-person rule. We never let our members be alone with a child or vice versa. And so what happens is, as long as the parents don't mind and the parents have the contact numbers for our two members that are assigned to that child, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime the child feels unsafe or the mother's got a question or a problem or a problem happens in the home with the perp, all they got to do is pick up the phone call. We'll be there within 30 minutes. The advantage that we have, if you think about it, over law enforcement or some of the other services they're providing the kids. We're available 24/7, 365. They're not.
Hmm. Well, we talked. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I know we talked a little bit earlier entering into the program about the stigma that some people still have about bikers. But I know with 15 years in, Happy, you can speak to the way you guys light up the faces of these kids when you come rolling up. They don't look at bikers the same way as adults do they?
No, not at all. You know, and the, like you said, the stigma around, quote, bikers is, and that's what it is, it's a stigma. People don't want to change because they may have had that bad experience or they saw something on TV and they figure everybody's that way. But if you ever looked in a paper or noticed anything, 75 to 80% of everything that's done as far as fundraising in a majority of the areas in the United States are done by bikers. And it's not money for their organization. It's money for kids, families, veterans, whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly see them stepping up every time one of our radio stations has a call for support. They are often right at the front of the line and in large numbers. And this is just another way to showcase the big heart that some of these rough characters may, you know, certainly have. Before we let you go, though, let folks listening know how they can help you. T, I know we talked for a couple seconds before we hit the microphone that you're hoping to have a late spring, early summer event and then another one coming up in the fall. What's on this slate right now with high hopes for the upcoming event, I guess in June, right?
Correct. Third Saturday in June, we're looking to have a fish fry.
Catfish.
Yep, with all the fixins, including hush puppies and fries and beer, soda. And that we'll have raffles months before the group goes out looking for corporations to support us.
Mm-hmm.
In these by donating things that we can raffle. Then all the money collected, including the whatever's paid in for food and the raffles, all goes towards our kids.
And people just need to go to BACAWorld.org and locate the Connecticut chapter and then key into the chapter site for all the local information. And you said there's that great video for them to watch and ways to learn how to get involved, right?
Correct. We are, BACA is a 501c3 organization, so anything that's donated for our raffles or donations to the chapter is fully tax deductible.
Very good. Well, as we hear, aside from the existing epidemic of child abuse here in Connecticut and across the country, COVID-19 has exacerbated the situation significantly, not just here, but globally. And BACA, Bikers Against Child Abuse, is ready to step up and help. They're ready to welcome new bikers into the family to boost their numbers and make an even bigger difference than they already have. Happy's been on board for 15 years, T for about 5. If you want to learn more, BACAWorld.org is the place to go to learn more here. And we want to thank you guys for getting in touch with us to remind us that April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and that BACA is one of the premier grassroots support and response organizations that are working to try to minimize it, stamp it out, and mitigate the effects by ensuring that no child has to be afraid here in the world that they live because of child abuse. So blessings to you guys and great appreciation and gratitude for all you're doing. And we can't wait to hear that the fish fry is on, and we'll be talking about that and making sure people get out to it to support you guys. So thanks for the time today, and enjoy the rest of April. I know you got your work cut out for you. Thanks for being on the program.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.